Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Where you were here, Jake, say
hello.
All right, that's good.
You heard me say it.
Now you've heard him say hello. Mm-hmm. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Well, we might as well talk about the stock market.
Yes.
Despite weak data, stocks bounce 1%. That's an interesting headline. I like that. There's a stock bounce. For those of you who didn't know what the weak data is, apparently, American companies and employers only created 142,000. That's the first estimate of four jobs last month. And that caused a shockwave to pass through the system where everybody became terrified that the sky was going to fall, the world was going to end, and the possibility exists that George Washington is dead.
Oh, my goodness. So, just a piece of news about that September data.
So
there are 3 points that we have talked about, 3 points in the year that we've talked about where the data is consistently wrong.
Mm-hmm.
One is the beginning of the year, January timeframe.
Right.
One is the beginning of summer, and one is the end of summer. The beginning of summer, they do, and the beginning of the year, all three of these points, they do big seasonal adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
One is based on weather in January. The other two are based on kids going to school versus work. If at the beginning of summer, there's this big boost in our job hiring, and at the end of summer, there's this big drop in hiring, and people's leaving jobs, and we're going, oh, no, it is a group of unemployed people. They're students. And September every year, they mess up. In June of every year, they mess up. In January of every year, they mess up.
I really do think there is a slack off in hiring, though, this time.
I agree.
And the reason was really, really clear. I know it requires a really deep long-term memory to go back to July. But in July...
That was a long time. How many years ago was July?
You got it. In July, there were some surveys, and I think it was the Wall Street Journal who actually did the main survey that I read, that noted that it's a CEO survey. Yes, Wall Street Journal, CEO survey. The CEOs said in the second half of the year, they anticipated hiring less people. And here's why. The Import-Export Bank had not been renewed.
Yep.
The budget ceiling was coming up. If you start down this list of things, and what they basically said, the CEOs, and this is not me saying this, this is the CEOs of countries across of companies across the country who were saying they were going to cut back on investment, they're going to cut back on hiring, they're going to basically sit on cash because they anticipated congressional instability that could dramatically affect the economy. In 2013, for those of you who can remember back that far, you may remember that the Republicans stated, and I got some criticism for blaming this on the Republicans, not the president. Hey, guys, the president isn't saying I want to shut down the government, but it's now called the Freedom Caucus instead of the Conservative Caucus.
Right.
In the House of Representatives, members routinely go on record as saying we want to shut down the government. And so I'm really going to give them credit for what they claim they want to do. I'm not trying to make a political statement against the conservatives in Congress. I'm simply saying they want to shut down the government, and they've stated they wanted to shut down the government. And they, by the way, were insisting that John Boehner shut down the government. So I'm going to give them credit if the government gets shut down because that's what they said they wanted to do. So what happened is, though, the CEOs were concerned that Congress was creating a business unfriendly, specifically the conservatives in Congress, are creating a very business unfriendly environment for them in the second half of 2015. And so they stated they were going to cut back on hiring, cut back on investment, cut back on all the stuff that makes the economy do well in the second half until we got through the debt ceiling, which, by the way, we hit in March. And on November 5th, the government shuts down if we don't get further ability to borrow. by the way, again, I want to emphasize something here. The debt ceiling is only raising the debt ceiling is only authorizing the Treasury to fund the bills that Congress already passed.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with cutting spending. It has to do with Congress passed bills that mandated the Treasury to spend money. It's more money than they pass bills to raise taxes for. Therefore, the Treasury has to borrow money.
It's like going to a, this is my analogy, I like it. It's like going to a restaurant with a wallet and some credit cards and no cash, sitting down and ordering a really nice meal. Then when the bill is presented saying, nope, not going to pay it, I've decided that I'm not going to get any more debt.
Right.
Well, if Congress ordered the meal, Congress either needs to pay for it with debt or with cash. If they don't have cash, they do it with debt.
Or change the law.
Or don't order the meal.
And, of course, the issue is only a minority of the members of the House of Representatives, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, has said he will raise the debt ceiling. But the Freedom Caucus in the House had said, we're going to do whatever we can to kill this thing. Admittedly, you have a minority of about, at most, 39 members of the House of Representatives who can't pass laws because there's 435 people there, and they feel very impotent. They feel very that they're not getting anything done because they don't have a majority. And what a minority, a determined minority, can sometimes do in our system is block things. They can't create things. So they're in the position where if they're going to do what we, and I say that we very, very consciously, because here in Bell County, we have John Carter, who is the secretary of that caucus, who is a determined member of that caucus. We sent him there to cut spending, and he wants to cut spending a lot, even though I don't think we'd like it if he did.
But that's what he was elected for. I mean, we said cut spending, and then we say don't cut spending when he gets there. That's a little bit
hypocritical. Yeah, but we do.
Hypocritical.
The people who vote in this county in the primary, and that's when it determines who's going to win, want to see the government cut spending. Now, this is the irony. If the government shuts down, or if the highway funding bill doesn't get passed, it's another thing that has to be passed.
Right.
This construction that we have going on in Bell County will freeze, and the highways will be left just like they are.
But it's everywhere.
Under construction mode.
It's not just Bell County. It's everywhere. And that's important to know. I'm going to throw in a piece of relatively good news. It doesn't look like good news on the surface, but if you dig down a little bit, it is really good news.
You're going to hurt our ratings.
I know. I shouldn't say good news. I should only talk about bad things, and otherwise people are going to change the channel. However, wage growth. So when we have a lower amount of hiring, 149,000, that's slightly less than we need to keep up with the new people coming into the workforce.
142.
Okay. Wage growth came in as a rise of 2.2%. Now, that doesn't sound like stand up and jump around for happiness here, except that wage growth has been pretty flat at near zero for a long time. So when wage growth is up at 2.2%, that's really great. People say, no, it doesn't sound so great, Jake. 2.2% is not that much. However, we have zero inflation. We have a little bit of disinflation. That means that we the different measurements of what's going on.
Disinflation?
Disinflation. They're saying disinflation because they say it's not really deflationary yet. And I'm like, yeah, it's deflation.
Ooh.
Okay. So disinflation is just a smarmy word for deflation.
Right. My tire is disinflated.
Right. It's deflated, dude. It's not inflated backwards. It's deflated. Inflation is the word we're modifying.
Outer space is disinflated.
Non-unambiguous.
Right.
Wait a minute. Okay, so coming back, that wage growth at 2.2%, a few years ago when we had inflation at 3%, if we had wage growth at 2.2% on top of inflation, we would have had a 5.2% wage growth. People would have said, that's great. Without inflation, having wage growth at 2.2% is really good. It's really good. And even though we're not hiring as much, the wages are being added. And in certain key industries, there are a lot of hiring. There is a lot of hiring going on. So we have a call waiting on 773-1400.
Indeed, we do. And caller, you're on the air on the Personal Wealth Coach. Can you hear me?
No.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Barely.
Okay, whoop, whoop. Yeah, that worked.
There we go. Hey, yeah. I know it seems like every year we talk about the government shutdown and raising the debt. Relatively speaking, you say the United States is in less debt than most other
big countries.
See a point where the debt ceiling is not raised every year, and what's it going to take to do that? I'll hang up on this.
Okay. The debt ceiling has to be raised for a very simple reason. The economy is growing. And when you measure debt as a percentage of the economy, you can't have something fixed. For example, the debt ceiling is set in dollars. And if you looked at let's go back 20 years, and I'll use this as a rather extreme example, or 30 years, and you looked at what a person living at the standard of living you have today made, if you were living at that same dollar value income today, your standard of living would be nowhere near what it is.
And if at that point in your life you said, I'm never going to get more debt than say you make, well, let's go back. Say you made $50,000 and you say, I'm never, ever going to take on more debt than $5,000. And now you make $500,000.
By the way.
Well, $5,000 isn't a lot of debt. You got to raise that number, and it is a percentage.
Cutting debt is the experiment that's running in Europe.
You don't do it when you're trying to recover from a downturn.
And it indicates, by the way, it may be appropriate for them, by the way, it indicates a nation or society in decline. Now, let me give you an example. If you start with a young person who has no debt, and they get married, they have children, they purchase a house, they do the things that indicate that they're growing and expanding and will have a better future than their present, economically and every other way, you will notice that their debt rises during that period of time. They buy cars and they buy houses and they may take loans out to put their kids through college. Now, once they go into retirement and they are declining in economic viability,
debt is not good at
that
point.
Where death is in sight out there at some point, they start reducing their debt. And the same is true of socioeconomic systems. If we ever get to the point where we don't have to raise the debt ceiling, we're dying. And I know a lot of people will object to that, saying there's absolutely no reason to have all this much debt. Again, look at a young family with several children who recently bought a house or bought a house in the last several years, who buys bigger cars to haul their children around. You will discover that their debt as a percentage of GDP is large.
And they're doing that because they expect to make more money in
the
future.
And that's very healthy. And as long as our nation is growing, and I certainly hope we continue to grow, and as long as our population is growing, and I certainly hope it continues to grow, we will need to take on a larger dollar value of debt with each passing year. And I want to remind you one other thing. Not only the United States, but the world uses our debt as money. I want to emphasize that again. The United States and most of the rest of the world, including the Chinese, use American debt obligations as money. You do. The dollar is a debt obligation of the United States government.
Well, indirectly. It's a debt obligation of the Federal Reserve, which then obligates the U.S.
Well, it's signed
government.
By the Treasury.
Right.
Signed by the... Matter of fact, the currency in circulation, the actual dollar bills that are floating around out there, are part of the debt.
They're IOUs.
And a healthy level of debt in a corporation or in a country indicates health. No debt. Dell was within days of bankruptcy at one point when it was in its best growth period. because they chose, because Michael Dell made a, in his opinion, they wanted to have no debt, never have any debt. And as a result, they put themselves in a position where they had expended all of their cash and were within days of bankruptcy. And somebody, Michael, I'm not Michael, Admiral Inman had to step in and talk some people into loaning some money to Dell to keep it from going bankrupt at the height of its growth. And this a knee-jerk reaction that says debt is bad doesn't make any sense. And I want to emphasize again, the Chinese, as a percentage of GDP, have a larger debt than we do.
Yeah, and let's take a step back, and that this is interesting, because people can obviously listen to the statement you just made and say, I'm looking at Wikipedia, and that's not right. You're looking at Wikipedia, and as a percentage of government debt, it isn't right. China doesn't have Social Security, doesn't have Medicare, doesn't have Medicaid, doesn't have all of these entitlements that we look at as obligations by us for future payment.
It also has huge off-the-books but real debt.
Yes.
That's where it hides its debt.
So if we look at our debt and we say, all right, there's a big chunk of our debt that is held by the government against the government, the Social Security Administration, the Medicare, Medicaid, all that good stuff, prescription drug benefit program, all that stuff is a debt that the United States government owes the United States government. If you have an IOU to yourself, all it takes is you forgiving it for it to go away. So take that aside for a second, because Germany doesn't do their books the same way. They don't look at the future obligations of their Social Security systems and their medical systems as a balloon note, because they're not a balloon note. You don't ever get a huge lump sum from Social Security. You get a monthly payment until it stops.
And Congress can change it anytime they want to.
Right. So that doesn't say it's a good system, but it's there. Okay, so we're just looking at the debt as it stands, not giving any judgment whether it's good or bad. A huge chunk of that debt is by the government to the government. They can forgive that. Another big chunk of the debt is by the public. That's the stuff that we should be looking at. And if we look at just at our to-the-public debt, or
debt held by the public, right, including the Chinese and everybody else.
What we're talking about there is a much, much smaller percentage of our GDP. Mm-hmm. It looks like a much healthier debt. Now, here's the problem, and we mentioned this earlier when a caller asked about the candidates' tax plans. Just because we can say that that debt can be forgiven doesn't mean that Social Security and Medicare and the prescription drug care benefit stuff isn't going to drain us dry. Because
It can be fixed.
It can be fixed. We need to work on it soon, but nobody seems to be working on it. They're looking at it as, if you talk about cutting Social Security, if you don't do it just right, it's suicide politically. If you want to cut Social Security... This is something I'm...
It is going to be cut.
I am younger than you. You are my father. That would be really hard for us to have it reversed.
You're also younger than the caller.
Yes. I don't expect to get Social Security.
That's right. And that's why...
I talk to people my age and younger, they don't expect to get Social Security.
And that's why when your generation takes over Congress... Now, my generation currently runs Congress.
Right. When my generation takes over, we're going to cut Social Security.
Because don't expect to get it.
Right. There are people that need it, that are going to be really, really low income in retirement. But my Social Security that I don't expect to get, that other people that look at this say, I don't expect to get this either, that's on the book as a debt. It's a debt to the United States government that we already don't expect to get paid. Because all over my Social Security estimate, it says, current estimates say this is what you get. But unless the tax code is changed, you don't get it. It says it on my estimate. It says, I'm not going to get my Social Security unless things change.
Right.
Even though it says right above that the number that I'm going to get.
Well, it's an estimate.
Yes, it's an estimate that then is followed by, but you're not going to get it.
Basically, we'll send you this money if taxes get raised. Or, and if they don't get raised.
Or if you have no money.
Right.
If you're going to starve to death, we're going to give you some money. But it's probably not going to be the amount that we're promising.
And right now, Congress is run by, and the majority of voters are people who expect to get their Social Security, and their attitude is, I don't care if it goes broke, I'm going to get mine. And that's the boomers. And once we pass out of the system, which won't be very far in the future, by the way, the Xers will take over, and one of the things they're probably going to do is say, this is silly. It is silly to continue to promise to pay people something that we know we're not going to pay them, so we're going to change the law, and we're going to say, if you make over this much money, or if you have over that much money in retirement, you don't get Social Security.
Well, that is not something that people are going to jump up and down in the public and say, yay, I don't get Social Security, but it is going to be good for the nation.
Mm-hmm. And so the issue is, if you take the Social Security debt and you assume that people who don't think they're going to get it
aren't going to get it.
So that's why the Germans don't count it. That's why the Spanish don't count it. That's why nobody counts that except the United States.
Right. The only obligation for Social Security that is there can be changed by an act of Congress.
Right. And so here's the point. Our national debt is 65-70% of GDP, which is healthy. I know that sounds ridiculous, but if you look at, again, let's just say a couple in their late 30s.
Who just bought a house.
Who moved from one house to another.
Their
debt-to-income
ratio is generally the other way around. They've got a $500,000 or $300,000 house,
right,
and they make $100,000.
But the point is that it is healthy. Now, the Chinese, on the other hand, have absolutely, the Chinese and Japanese both, have unsustainable debt levels.
Yeah.
The Chinese debt isn't their official governmental debt that's held in the equivalent of their treasury securities. It is bonds that have been issued by state-owned companies, including the ones that built these ghost cities. They borrowed money from the Chinese public, and they used the money to do something that produces no money.
They're not going to get paid for that money.
And if you took the debt owed by the state, what they're called, state-owned enterprises, I love that term, and you applied it to, and you add it to the debt that the Chinese government officially owes, you realize that their debt-to-GDP ratio is higher than ours. And they don't have Social Security. And they don't have Medicare.
They don't have
unemployment.
Right. Flip a demographic issue in there. People are worried about China being the next big thing. One grandchild has four grandparents. That's not too unusual. Most grandchildren have all four grandparents. In China, however, those grandparents only have one grandchild.
Right.
Because it's a one-child policy, and their kids...
Third generation.
Right. The grandparents had a child, and that child married one other child. Well, they were hopefully adults when it happened, so some time had to take place in the middle of that.
They were child adults.
Right.
Which we have a lot of in the United States,
yes,
too.
And
a lot of them in
those
Congress.
Two people who are no longer children and are now married have a child. That young Chinese boy or girl...
It's got to support six people.
Right. And in the prime of their life... By law, their parents and their grandparents will be living in their house... And it's not just six people, because if that person gets married, it's those two people are supporting 12 people even before they have kids,
right,
or a kid.
And that is a suicidal
It can't work. So if we applied the same rationale to the Chinese debt as we do to Social Security and Medicaid, we're talking about thousands of times GDP in the future for their obligations on old age care and medical care.
Let me throw something else in here that people are probably, I mentioned this before. I saw the article again today and researched it again today. The Hispanics and more, it used to be the largest immigrant group in the United States, people who were born outside the United States who currently live in the United States. This is from the Census Bureau.
Right. Hispanics, people who speak Spanish language.
Listen,
right.
The largest number of people who were born outside the United States who currently live in the United States without regard to where they came from,
uh-huh,
or whether they're legal or illegal, used to be Mexican.
Right.
No more. The largest set and the largest nationality both are from the same place now in the United States. Immigrants who are living in the United States, who are born outside the United States, Chinese. And the flows into the United States from China are very substantially larger than from Mexico. Now, the next thing I want to tell you, you think I'm going to be nuts. For the last 2 years, the number of Mexican-born people in the United States leaving and going back to Mexico have exceeded the number coming in from Mexico. So we have a steady drain of both legal and illegal immigrants from Mexico back to Mexico because a lot of automakers have moved, for example, their manufacturing and assembly plants to Mexico because the labor is a lot cheaper and the government has sort of encouraged them to do it so as to prevent illegal immigration. That's number one. Number two, and you're not going to like this, folks, President Obama has got the tightest anti-illegal immigration program and the largest deportation program in the history of the United States by several factors. I mean, huge factors. He's deported many hundreds of thousands of people, and the border security is tightened up tremendously. It's very hard to get back in the United States. Now, yeah, you may say, but I see an awful lot of people who speak Spanish. Well, hate to break this to you, but the vast, vast, vast majority, like over 90% of those people you see were born in the United States. They are second-generation Hispanics. Their parents, in many cases, have gone back to Mexico. They were born here. They're U.S. citizens. They just speak Spanish. And they are gradually learning to speak English. But the big influx of immigration into the United States right now, and the huge variance here since the Great Recession, have been Chinese. Megan, you're frowning, but I can show you the census data.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. It's as of 2 years ago, but Mexico is by far the biggest as of 2 years ago, but it may be that the biggest immigrant population, not the biggest inflow. So you're talking about inflows.
I'm talking about the actual article was in the Wall Street Journal. It's from, I think, July, and it's either May, June, July time frame. And they state that the Census Bureau determined that now I'm not talking about people who speak Spanish or with Hispanic surnames. I'm talking about when they surveyed the people who were born somewhere other than the United States who currently live in the United States. The Chinese passed the Mexicans. And I can...
I'll find it. I agree with you.
Wall Street Journal, October 10th, 2014 is one of the articles. But that's when it first started coming up. The share of immigrants in the U.S. population rose last year to 13.1%. This is the highest since the 1920s. By the way, in the late 1800s, we had a mass immigration in the United States.
Right.
We had multiples. Like 15% of the population born someplace else. In 1970, it dropped to 4.7%, and that's what we consider to be normal. And so in 2013, it was up to 13% again. However, this is where it started. That's when it first started to show up, that the people coming into the United States turned out to be more from China than from Mexico, right about that point. And it's accelerated since then. And I can get you the data if you want it.
Yeah, I'd like that.
Okay. But anyway, this is one of those things that we see happening. That runs counter to the perception and the political rhetoric, but it's reality. As a matter of fact, one of the things that came up in the construction report that just came out, one of the reasons the construction industry is not growing as fast as it otherwise would, they did a survey and they said they're having a lot of trouble finding workers.
Right.
And they're driving a lot of trouble finding workers because the workers mostly went back to Mexico.
Yeah.
And the construction industry people are saying that. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know you have disclosures on some of the ads on your station, but you hear these ads about forgive, you know, all your debt can be forgiven, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
You know, under the premise there's no free lunch. What's the real story behind those ads? I'll hang up on this.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
What's the real story? Yeah, Ed Laughlin is the expert on that.
But. Yeah, he's a bankruptcy attorney, and even in bankruptcy, yes, you get some of your debt forgiven, but the attorney gets paid.
The point is that there are organizations out there that short of bank who will go to your creditors. If you if you're in a position where you could declare bankruptcy and you've got a lot of debt on the books and you can't actually pay it, you've lost your job, you're in a position where things are, you're just not going to be able to pay your debt. What happens is these organizations go to your creditors and say, here's what is going, one of two things is going to happen. They're either going to go see Ed Laughlin.
You get a bankruptcy.
And declare bankruptcy, and you're not going to get diddly squat. Or you can cut this guy's debt or this family's debt by this percentage, and we will help them. You know, we will collect the money from them and distribute it to you in exchange for we'll take a, you know, of course they don't say that to them. But what happens is they get paid by the companies they negotiate with, and then you also a percentage of the money that you are sending to pay off your debts at that point. Then goes to whatever firm this is, and that's where they make their money. And they make that's why they have a minimum level of debt before they'll mess with you, because they have to have enough cash flow that they can take a percentage of it and make a profit. And they know how to play hardball, and they know how to threaten these guys, and it's cheaper for the company to write down some of the debt if they're convinced you can't pay it. And so,
But you have to pay for not paying.
Yeah, and your credit report will get a hit on it that says that you are bad. And the other thing that's going to happen is the IRS is going to look at all that forgiven debt, and they're going to credit it to you as income, and you're going to pay taxes on it.
Yeah.
And so that's the catch. It, you know,
there, that's an important factor in student loan forgiveness, in tax forgiveness, in lots of things, is that the government sees that as income.
And we got to do some commercials, speaking of income. So you're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we really haven't talked a lot about stocks.
We haven't really mentioned the market much at all.
Yeah, we probably ought to. Anyway, we'll be discussing that kind of stuff when we come back after these important words from Town Square's sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake McClure. And the telephone numbers in here remain 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And for anyone who was listening to a podcast when I referred to Ed Laughlin, I was referring to the person who has the radio program just before our program, who is Ask a Lawyer, and he does a lot of bankruptcy work, and that's why I was saying Ed Laughlin. Okay.
Right.
Makes sense.
And you sent me the article from the Wall Street Journal with the inflows of immigration, and it's really good looking stuff. The big chunk of it is the age of the the biggest age group that's coming to the United States is between the ages of 20 and 24, and they generally are students, and they come over, obtain their citizenship, and stay. These are the type of people that we really
want to come to the United States.
It's
healthy immigration. And there's another article I could send you to. But anyway, it really boils down to the fact that the immigration pattern is changing. Mexico's economy is actually improving. And believe it or not, it has been a coordinated effort of three presidents in a row now to improve the Mexican economy, encourage people, for example, encourage a company that is going to move its manufacturing outside the United States anyway to move it to Mexico. Why? Because if there's lots of good jobs in Mexico, then fewer people will illegally come across the border into the United States, and that will make everybody happy. And oddly enough, through both political parties and a very consistent effort, and by the way, the Obama administration has really been cranking on this effort. You know, they don't, he's not all bad. They have really done a good job at reducing illegal immigration in the United States, and actually started to move legally and without in law enforcement activity, move a lot of illegal immigrants back out of the United States. And the issue is you give them a job at home in Mexico, and they go back to Mexico. Now, the interesting thing about the people coming in from China, and I don't have an article that I can actually give you, although I've read this, a lot of the Chinese students who come over to the United States on student visas, at the end of their student visas, don't leave. They are illegal immigrants. But since we're so focused on Hispanic illegal immigrants, it's not really all that hard for them to get away with it. And particularly if they have degrees, and at some point they apply for, they find a corporation where they can work, and they apply for a work visa. And lo and behold, what they have to do, by the way, this is an interesting thing. Unlike the Hispanics, this is a fascinating thing. They have to go outside the United States to apply for their work visa, okay? You know where they go? Canada. And this is why. We have a policy concerning China that we don't force people to go back to communist China. And it's a bill that was enacted in, I think, under the Nixon administration that basically says that there are certain countries in the world that have communist repressive governments, and we don't force people who arrive here from there to go back there because they ain't ever going to get out again, and that was a given. So what they do is they go to Canada and simply mail the letter from Canada. They're technically outside the United States at that point, and then they come back into the United States on their student visa. And they do this, by the way, just before their student visa runs out.
Right.
And this is a little cottage industry of going to Canada and mailing a letter in saying, I want to work in the United States and I have a job, and here's the company I have a job with. And it's almost a knee-jerk reaction, by the way, at this point. The person is in Canada. They are educated. There is a high-tech job waiting for them, and there's a specific kind of visa that they can get. And pretty soon, they're here, and then after they've been here for a while, they
can apply for citizenship.
They apply for citizenship. Now, we don't want to mess with that, by the way, because that means we get the smart people, and the Chinese don't get to keep them.
Right. Let me switch the subject a little bit, but it's not that much of a switch, because the Georgia Institute of Technology, Georgia Tech in Atlanta, has a group of students, and I'm saying that it's not that big of a switch because you can read the names of the students and you can figure out where they're from. They've just published a paper on something called a rectina, which sounds pretty horrible.
Yeah, it's. I'm not even going to go with the rectina, but go ahead.
It's a rectifier antenna at the nanoscale, extremely small. We're talking about very, very small. But there have been some leaps ahead in solar technology in the nano world with these antennas that produce a great deal more electricity for the sunlight than our current technology. Now, it's a long ways out because it's going to take a lot of money to get this up to a higher scale. But the effect of it is a near 90% efficiency rate in converting. That is massive.
I saw The Martian last night, and they had some rect antennas.
Yeah, rect antennas. So this concept is, I'm saying this because I try to throw in a couple of new invention-type ideas to let people know that America is still the center of innovation for the world. If you look at the types of things that we're doing, there's a 3D printer that's printing scaffolding for neural growth now. So if you been paralyzed, basically they print a scaffold and lay your nerves into it and then put a solution in there to help your nerves grow, and you can get feeling back. These are really cool advancements that are taking place here. As bad as everything is, it's not bad. It is really, really, really good. It's just easy to look at all the bad things.
I want to throw a couple of things in here as we coast down in the last 10 minutes of the program. The third quarter saw a loss about 7% in the markets. It's over. October is historically a very volatile month in the markets. We'll probably continue to see a lot of ups and downs. There is the potential, particularly with Speaker Boehner stepping down at this point, there is the potential, which is going to impact, unless we get it fixed in advance, it's going to probably impact the markets in October, the potential that we could have a government shutdown. A government shutdown, the last time we did it, caused the markets to drop about 11%. Now, that unfortunately is a reality. There's a potential that we won't reenact the import-export bank. The conservatives are against that. That also will cost the economy a lot of jobs and a lot of strength as it moves someplace else. I'm not trying to knock, and believe me, I'm not trying to knock the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives. I'm simply acknowledging that they have an agenda that has potentially going to cause some unhappiness in the stock market. And just be aware of that. But it doesn't detract from the underlying health of the United States economy right now. The United States economy is the healthiest economy, the healthiest major economy, certainly, on the planet. It is, we just broke all records for September auto sales. And we're on track in the United States for the highest number of automobiles sold since 2000. Another small number that just went by that no one seems to be paying a lot of attention to. We now have employed in the United States of America more people than we did in 2007. Now, the economy, the population has grown since then. So it's not the same percentage, but we still actually have as many jobs today as we did before the recession that began late 2007. And so things are picking up and they're moving. Our consumer spending went up very nicely year over year, a relatively surprising amount. As a matter of fact, for whatever it's worth, consumer purchases in the United States are significantly larger than the entire Chinese economy. I want to say that again. Consumer purchases alone, not manufacturing, not exports, not defense, not any of that other stuff. Just the stuff that you and I buy on a monthly basis.
Well, more than just you and I. But you being a very large you. More than just the listening
the collective,
audience.
The collective, and I'm going to use this term intentionally, euphoric you or metaphoric you. And I.
You say euphoric because that would be very happy.
Yeah, well, I think.
The happy you.
People who go out and buy things tend to be happy. Paying off the debt makes them unhappy. But this is what I want to try to point out is, number one, the United States is the dominant power on the globe, continues to be the dominant power on the globe, and is growing and is relatively healthy. And more than relatively, we're quite healthy. Yes, the labor participation force is declining. There's a very, very good reason for that. There's a bunch of us old guys who are retiring. And there's a lot of wives of the old guys who really don't think they need to work anymore. And there's a bunch of young, particularly women, and in some cases men, who've decided to take care of their children rather than work. This is a demographic trend. It's going on. And
we're also having a baby boom.
We're having a baby boom because of that. And the other thing is, our productivity is rising, unlike Europe's, unlike China's.
China's productivity is dropping
so
at the moment.
When we can increase, that means we can increase what we're producing, but have fewer people doing it. That's productivity. And that's a good thing. And if you want to portray it as a bad thing, you can. You can say, oh, no, there's the labor participation force. The labor participation is low.
Yeah, the French look at it this way. They say if you're being too productive, you need to go home so that we can hire other people. Otherwise, you're going to take the jobs of everyone else by being too productive. We look at it as you just create more jobs by being more productive.
By the way, in the jobs report that just came out, the unemployment rate for college graduates among people who want to work is 2.9%.
What that says is get your kids a college education.
And you can see that the unemployment, the problem where we can't get people employed are people who don't even have a high school education. It really boils down to the fact that we are approaching full employment in the United States right now. That means wages should probably start to go up, and I sincerely hope the Fed will actually put 0.25% in there someplace.
Right. The open jobs listing is high enough right now that if they were able to hire from the unemployed job pool, we would have a very, very low unemployment. But they can't hire from the unemployed job pool because they don't have the skills. So if you have the skills, you can get a job. That's what I'm saying. Right now, it is not.
Yeah.
It isn't the other way around. Wages are going up. That means that employers feel like they need to hold on to the people that they have because their competitors want to hire their staff. And if they don't raise the wages, just a couple of years ago, you didn't have to hire staff from your competitors. You just went to the job pool and said, oh, there's a whole bunch of people that want a job.
So we are having a little bit of an employment problem in the United States. And the thing is, we're short of workers. And skilled workers who want to work are in relatively short supply. this is a problem that we've run into in the past and we'll probably run into in the future. And I think it has become kind of a staid thing. As a matter of fact, I saw The Intern recently, which I think is a great movie everybody should go see.
Haven't seen it yet.
And one of the things that becomes very, very clear is that there's a set of people who are still living with their parents who don't have much of a work ethic, and as their parents kick them out, they figure out they have to get jobs.
Well, let me tell you something that I see anecdotally, and I see this only anecdotally because I haven't been reading reports on this, though there are some good reports out there on household formations. A lot of the young people that I am seeing as clients, a lot of them I'm not charging because or charging very small amounts because they just don't have a lot of money, are living with their parents, and they have huge savings that they've been putting together because they want to buy a house.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a lot harder to buy a house than it used to be. And by huge savings, I mean these are 24, 25-year-olds with $50,000 in the bank that they have been saving every year as much as they can so that they can buy a house eventually.
And I really
they're getting close to that point where they're ready to act on it.
I just read about that, and there's a really interesting conundrum here. If they have to pay rents, they can't, because rental charges are so high, they can't afford to buy, to save up the money
so
necessarily to buy a house. And
they're living with their parents.
Why are rents so high and houses so hard to buy? It really comes down to not the regulations, because the government's trying to get them to loan money.
Right.
It comes down to the fact that there's a shortage of, and you're going to think this is crazy, Hispanic workers to build the houses.
Yes, the construction.
Because they've gone back to Mexico or been deported.
Which means that technology is going to replace that. And that's what happens in these situations. It may take a few years, but the 3D printers are already beginning to build houses. And it's going to be you're not going to have a lot of people on a job site in the future. It's going to be a couple of machines that go out there and spend a couple of days building a house.
That I'm looking forward to.
And that's going to be how the house gets built. And it's going to be cheaper.
Then we'll see people buying houses again.
Yeah.
But there is a problem right now in that the price of a new house has gone up dramatically. It's a good news if you own a house, because across the nation we've had a 5% year-over-year increase in the price of existing residences, which is unusual in a zero inflation environment. But that's what's going on, and it causes a temporary distortion, and people get very upset about it. But like I said, I still think, by the way, 2016 will be the year we see, and I've been saying this now for about 3 years.
Right.
2016 will be the year we see the economy hitting on all cylinders.
Yeah, and it's not going to matter who's president at that point.
Well, I know who will be president in 2016, unless he gets killed.
Well, yeah, in 2017, whoever takes over is going to be able to take credit for all kinds of good things.
Right. And I can tell you historically which party wins when you have a booming economy when there's an election going on, and you're not going to like it.
Right, and there's a sad piece here for the Republicans in that if we had had this correction in October of next year instead of October of this year, it may have altered the election. It may have caused a Republican to come in. But right now, there's a Democrat in office, and if the economy looks good while a Democrat's in office, that's how people tend to vote.
And I'll also tell you, and this is from a guy who has had Republican stamped on his card for more years than I can count.
I have nothing stamped on my card.
Well,
I have no party stamped on my card, which I'm very proud of.
There's a reality, and the reality is right now, the middle America and the employers see the Republicans in the House of Representatives as a threat to their economic well-being. This does not bode well for the general election next year, because people's memories do last 1 year, at least.
Sometimes.
And
just trying to remember back to July.
But then you get an emotional
heart.
If somebody scares you and you think they're going to wreck your business by killing the export-import bank, which one party is trying to do.
Yeah, I think that's stupid. I don't know what they're thinking.
Then,
I really don't understand that.
And you get the free enterprise people against the conservatives, and it's going to be bad. Anyway, you have been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. In case you didn't already have all this, you can call us off the air. You can we have voicemail on the weekends, people during the week, at 947-1111 locally. That's 947-1111. It's a hard number to remember.
You can also reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We actually read our emails, and we will talk about it on the air if it's a good enough subject. It's where we get some of our greatest subjects. If you would like to see our ugly mugs and look at our beautiful staff, go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read the podcast or listen to podcasts, read the newsletters, and until next week.
Balance. Your the Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.